Good morning. We'd like to call to order the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes, Wednesday, March 20th, 2013, 9:12 a.m. First order of business is consideration of the minutes of the Tax Reform Division of Thursday, March 14th. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, Senator Coonan moves adoption of the minutes for Thursday, March 14th. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. First bill before us this morning is Senate File 1225, Senator Stumpf. Members, I think that you may have gotten, as he's coming forward, have gotten another email from Mr. Senek about not touching the microphones. Every time you twist them around, the wires inside short out, and they have to come in and repair them. So please don't touch the fixed mics. Thank you very much. Senator Stumpf, Senate File 1225.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 1225 is an attempt to try to address a problem that has been around for some time, and that is the number of dentists in the state of Minnesota that do not see patients that are on medical assistance. And this issue kind of was magnified through a legislative auditor's study of the whole problem of the lack of dentists who are actually seeing patients that are on medical assistance. The problem goes back to the lack of reimbursements that has occurred over a period of time, and so a lot of dentists that I've talked to have been losing money, and for a long time they actually saw medical assistance patients, but the current situation is so out of whack with what the cost of providing care that they just can't afford to do it anymore. So what,
Senator Stumpf, I believe you have an amendment. Would you like to have us adopt the amendment so that you can discuss it with the proposal actually going forward?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, it's the A1 amendment.
Okay. Do members have the A1 amendment now?
It's coming out now.
And then there is a new summary of Senate File 1225 as proposed to be amended by the A1.
Madam Chair and committee members.
Just a moment then. Senator Gazelka moves the A1 amendment. Sure. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Stumpf.
Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment. I want to thank Senate Counsel and the Department for working on this. This is a much more streamlined approach and simplified approach compared to the language in the bill. What we're attempting to do is to allow the loss that dentists would occur by seeing medical assistance patients for that loss, a partial amount of that loss to be allowed for a deduction off of their income. And the hope is that it's up to a maximum of $25,000. If they would reach that, they'd have to see X number of medical assistance patients, and then they would be able to, at the end of the year, deduct that much as any other deductible expense. And that's really the kind of the heart of the bill. It's trying to come at helping ease the problem from the kind of a revenue perspective versus trying to look at increasing the appropriation side of it. Now, obviously, I think to a large extent, actually both are needed, but I think once we could get the dentist back into the servicing of the medical assistance patients, and it's in particular a problem in rural areas where people who are on medical assistance have to drive long, long distances. In my district, for example, some of the people who are up in northwestern Minnesota have to drive to Bemidji, which is, you know, hundreds of miles in some cases one way. So care isn't provided to a lot of people who need it. So I have Dominic here who can probably give more details on the specifics in terms of numbers, but and maybe we should do that.
Yeah, let's have I have a few questions, but let's have the testimony first. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dominic Spizzetto. I am the lobbyist for the Minnesota Dental Association. I'm filling in for Senator Stump's dentist who couldn't make it down here this morning, but I do want to praise Senator Stump for discussing this issue with his local dentist for a couple of years and attempting to work out some solutions for what we think is a very, very major problem. I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes trying to give you an overview of how we got to where we are today. In the 1960s, when Medicaid was first enacted, there was a dental benefit included in that for children, and Minnesota has opted to include an adult benefit in their Medicaid program as well. And at that time, fees were established by the Department of Human Services. It was an annual update. Dentists would obviously, all practitioners would submit their fees. The department would discount it a certain amount, but they would publish a fee schedule, and that was what everyone worked off of. In the 1980s, when the state ran into a severe budget crisis, that was taken over by the legislature. So there was a statutory fee base that was enacted for health care providers, physicians, dentists, chiropractors, podiatrists, and others. And that's been in the statute since then. And that was in 1981. Since that time, there's probably been one major update of that schedule. And that brought us up to the fee base of the median fees offered in 1989. And we've stayed that way for many, many years. There have been several Band-Aid approaches. We've increased reimbursement for some services. there were also some rateable reductions that were put on and then taken off. And then last year, there was a 3% reduction added on to the fee structure. Another attempt we made to address this issue was something called the Critical Access Dental Provider Program. And this was an attempt to try and reward the dentists that were still out there in greater Minnesota and in the metro area that were serving the greatest amount of Medicaid recipients. So we put in a threshold, I believe it was 20%. If you had more than 20% of your practice in Medicaid public assistance Minnesota care, you would receive an increased reimbursement of about 50%. And that was to try and get them up to their cost basis. Generally speaking, the reimbursement for dentists under the state system is about 35% of their charged fees. Their overhead is significant. It's about 65 to 70% of their charged fees. So they lose about half of the money that comes in on every single medical assistance patient they see. And that's documented by the American Dental Association, and it's consistent throughout the country. Overhead expenses such as staff, materials, and others. What makes dentistry a little more difficult in terms of the overhead is the fact, and from your own personal experience, you can remember this, when you go into the dental office, you're going into a mini operatory, and there are a lot of things that have to be done in terms of sterilization, infection control, or whatever, for every single patient you see. It's not as simple as going and asking a few questions and getting a prescription. You have to have a physical examination of your oral cavity with all of the sterilization and infection controls and things that are involved in that. So that creates a higher overhead. And material expenses have increased rather dramatically over the last several years. So I think the issue is that we wanted to try and help those providers that were doing the greatest amount of service. So we set up this critical access dental program. In 2010, because of, again, budget constraints, private practice was eliminated from the critical access provider program. Basically left that for nonprofit clinics, federally qualified health care facilities, and health partners. That was a major blow, especially to greater Minnesota. And we've had several practices close because of that issue. We had two in southeastern Minnesota that had to close their doors because they had over 80% population of Medicaid and Minnesota Care patients. And they closed. We have practitioners in Senator Stump's district who are on the verge of quitting the program. Since 2010, about 30% of the dentists that were in the program no longer see Medicaid patients. They're still enrolled. They continue to see patients of record that they've had in their practice, but they're not accepting new patients. So we've been working with legislators and particularly the legislative auditor, and I think you'll see the results of his report in the article in the paper, and I hope you get a chance to look at the report summary. It really is right on. It hits all of the points. The fact that the system is broken, the reimbursement is horribly low. We have 13 different payment systems for different providers, so they're never really quite sure who they're working with and what they're getting paid. And it's a mess. So it's even a bigger problem as the population shift increases and we see older dentists retiring and younger dentists coming out of dental school trying to set up practices or buy practices or go into the profession. And they're coming out of school with debts of anywhere from $200,000 to $300,000. And then we expect them to go into a practice, set up a practice, cover the overhead, and they will not be able to see these patients because they can't afford to lose that kind of money up front. So what we're trying to do here today, I think, is a step in the right direction. This would give dentists who continue to see Medicaid patients an opportunity to take a write-off from their income tax, state income tax. It would be helpful. It's not going to solve the problem. I think you can understand the enormity of the problem given the reimbursement level. But I'd like to applaud Senator Stump for bringing this forward, and I urge you to give it favorable consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spazzetto. I have a few questions. In the Health and Human Services budget division, are you aware of any action there being considered that would alleviate the situation with regard to dentists, Senator Stump? Are they talking about it at all?
Madam Chair and members, no, Senator Lori is an author on the bill, and I have discussed this proposal with him. And there's a couple areas where we have some dramatic, some big problems out there. One is in the nursing home area, and the other is in the dental care area. And sometimes the dental care kind of gets pushed aside because it seems like you can get by without having that care, and particularly, I think children are not getting the care when they can't have that kind of availability to the professionals. But I don't know of any proposal as such to increase the reimbursements.
Senator Stump or Mr. Spazzetto, maybe, or the department, the subtraction that you're proposing would be either on the individual income tax, however the income is earned, whether the dental practice is a sole proprietorship or any other kind of pass-through entity or any kind of pass-through entity, and then a similar subtraction allowed for corporations. Do you know how many dental practices are incorporated as C corps? Even aside from the governor's proposal with regard to rate changes in the corporate and the individual income tax, seems to me the subtraction would be worth either more or less, depending on how you organized your practice. I was just wondering if, and I see, or I don't see a revenue estimate with the A1 amendment. I wonder if the department could come forward and just kind of tell us how they are how they're going about doing an estimate, and if you could respond to my questions with regard to practices. I would assume that few of them are incorporated as C corps. Most are maybe LLCs or partnerships or sub S or something like that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Susan Von Mosch with the Department of Revenue. The way the bill is drafted right now, it is drafted to both the individual income as a subtraction, both to individual income tax and to corporate taxes. We do not have a revenue estimate. I'm not sure exactly when this bill was scheduled for hearing, but I think we are still working on gathering information. Ms. McQuay may be able to provide more information on that. I do know that our person is working with the Department of Human Services to gather information, and I would have to go back and check with them about your question in terms of the if we have information on the type of business
organization. I'm assuming when we see a revenue estimate, it will separate out the impact on the individual income tax and on the corporate income
Madam
tax.
Chair, yes, that's how we normally would draft a revenue estimate with a bill drafted this sort of way.
Ms. McQuay, do you have any additional information you could provide at this time?
Madam Chair and members, I did have some communication with revenue this morning, and they're approximating, based on numbers that they received from DHS this morning, about $8 to $9 million a year. Let's not hold them to that.
Split how?
I'm not sure. We didn't get that breakdown, Madam Chair.
Okay, I think that will be of a lot of interest to us. And, of course, this proposal is scalable. You have a $25,000 cap. It could be $15,000 or $10,000 or any kind of help. So we want to get as much information about how many practices would be affected and how they're organized so that we can understand if we move forward in this area, which is a little bit unusual for the tax committee, but if we move forward in this area that we understand what we're getting into. Senator Gazelka and then Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Chair, excuse me. But Senator Stump, first of all, thank you for bringing this forward. Trying to find some solutions. I hope this could be part of it, but also that we consider doing something on the other side as far as reimbursement rates. I've talked to a number of rural dentists, and if they're in their older part of their career, they're just doing this out of their good nature. I mean, it's pro bono. They're losing money, but they've already made their wealth, and so it's their way of giving back. But the new dentists cannot do this, and so as we have this turnover, you know, we have less and less people out there really helping those that are in the most need. But the question I have for you is if we do this and this alone, is this going to move the bar at all as far as dentists that might still consider doing this work? Because to me, it doesn't appear that this will bring us even close to break even. So just either your thoughts or Mr. Spicetto.
Before you go on, maybe, too, we will make sure that the members of the division have the we should have done that. I neglected that. The legislative auditor's report, at least the executive summary, so that we can understand how desperate, actually, this situation is. So we'll make sure that gets to the members so we have information from the program evaluation that the OLA did. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment. I think in the meetings that I've had with dentists primarily in my area, northwestern Minnesota, there is I think you described very accurately, the older dentists have kind of that commitment to just to be helping people. And in fact, I think up in Bemidji in June, they have, we had some legislation last year. They have a day where they actually they bring in dentists from all over and, you know, other states even, and they open it up for a weekend to help anybody that comes free of charge. So I think the real impetus isn't so much that this is going to turn everything around, but I think a lot of the dentists that I've talked to are somewhat demoralized in the sense that the reimbursement rates go back to the 80s. And as mentioned, the reimbursement rate is 35% of what their actual costs are. And so dentists that I've talked to have been losing money treating MA patients for, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. So I think what this does, however it would be adjusted, would give them a sense that the people, the leaders at the Capitol care, and the public kind of has a sense of they would have a sense that they're being helped. And I think that's probably as important as the actual dollar amount.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Stumpf, thank you for bringing this forward. I think you're recognizing a need that many of us in the rural areas have recognized for a while. My question is to the testifier. We are going to get a revenue estimate of the cost of Senator Stumpf's proposal here, but I was curious, when they eliminated private practices from qualifying for this critical care access clinics, do you recall the savings that was achieved by that elimination? And the reason I'm asking that is I'm wondering if there might not be a more effective use of our dollars than just this proposal here. If we could do something as an appropriation that would reach more people and be more effective, I think that might be an approach that we should be exploring.
Mr. Sposetto.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the exact amount on that. I think it was somewhere between $7 and $8 million for that particular program. But I should add that we are we're approaching this from a multifaceted attempt to increase reimbursement. The governor has included in his budget a 5% increase for all practitioners, including dentists.
What would the overall increase then in the reimbursement be at a 5% level, Mr. Sposetto?
The 5% level would bring us up to about 38% to 39% of your charge. So,
and how much more money is what I'm asking? Total
dollars across the board for all providers, including physicians and others, is $27 million. We haven't seen it broken out individually for dentists versus physicians.
That would be that breakout would also be of interest, I think, to the
okay.
tax committee too.
Hopefully,
if you
I'll
get
be able
that,
to get
if
that
you
from
could
the
provide it to yes. our offices. That
yes, we'll try and get
great.
That from the Department of Human Services. I should also add that Senator Reinert has introduced a bill to raise the base rate from 1989 to this century. He has a bill in that would bring it up to 2011. So whatever you would pay the dentist, it would at least be based on 2011 charges, which are more modern than what we have now.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, would they be going back and analyzing the actual costs of the dentists are incurring and then adjusting their reimbursement to that, or would they just be doing an inflationary adjustment on current costs?
Mr. Sposetto.
Mr. Chairman, it was our hope that they would raise it rather significantly. In fact, we had targeted it at 75% of the fee schedule in 2011. That's a $97 million appropriation. And that's kind of displays the issue we're talking about, how much the dentists have been writing off over the years. We're hopeful to get that. We're realistic as well. But we are really working on increasing the fees to entice new people into the program. I think this particular legislation will help those that are doing it now because they'll be aware of this. I'm not sure we'll do anything to increase access for new recipients without something else happening at the same time. So,
Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Stump. I think this is creative, and I appreciate the discussion. I've talked to many dentists in my area and throughout Minneapolis, and I would say frustration is a word that they mention a lot, and it's not just a rural Minnesota issue. There's access issues in low-income areas throughout the metro area, too. So I think this is a start, and thank you for bringing this forward to have the discussion.
Is there further discussion or questions for Senator Stump or Mr. Sposetto? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on Senate File 1225 as amended? Seeing none, thank you very much, Senator Stump, and we'll lay over Senate File 1225 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
The next bill on our agenda is Senate File 1237. Senator Dibble. There are some handouts, members coming around. I'm assuming these are from Senator Dibble. Is that correct?
I think all but one of them is from me. I think the one on top there is not from me. That's from the business partnership.
Maybe, as people are
get another handout,
they
can
identify. We should put their names on it so we know where things are coming from. We'll do that in the future. So, Senator Dibble, Senate File 1237 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1237 seeks to minimize the level of tax avoidance that some Minnesota companies undertake through techniques that are that allow them to attribute profits or shift profits to subsidiary companies that are in other countries. When a company develops a subsidiary, locates an actual business operation in another place, perhaps manufactures products and sells those products overseas, finds financing, et cetera, that's well and good. And in, even in those instances, sometimes when those profits are repatriated through dividends or royalty payments or the like back to the parent company in the United States, there is some taxation that occurs. But a number of other things are going on, Madam Chair and members, that make this bill necessary. For a lot of companies, the location in another country is on paper only. Companies are claiming substantial business operations on a level that far outstrips what's actually occurring. And in fact, in some of these countries, if you're to look at the level of profits that are claimed as attributable to business activity in those countries, it's many, many times the gross domestic product of that particular country. Some of the techniques that they use, internal pricing techniques, when a subsidiary in a low or no tax country charges very, very high prices to another subsidiary of that company, reducing the profit artificially of the company located in the U.S. By creating a great deal of expense of that company in the U.S. Deferral of income, I talked about repatriating royalties, repatriating dividends. Sometimes that just simply never occurs. Transferring research and development. Interestingly, oftentimes companies in the United States take advantage of a lot of tax breaks and tax credits that we provide through some programs that we have for that are capital in nature, that also recognize research and development efforts. But then the results of that research and development, the profits are treated as foreign income by those companies. Also related to the research and development function, those processes or patents are transferred to subsidiary corporations in other countries, and then the income is attributed there. And then financing techniques. Financing is run through the foreign subsidiary, allowing the interest deduction to be taken here in the United States, but the income that's paid or received by the foreign company is not taxed because it's in these lower no-tax havens. So, Madam Chair and members, sometimes these techniques are legal, and so that's up for us to decide whether or not they're advisable. Sometimes there's shaving of the intent and purpose, particularly when we're talking about some of these internal pricing techniques. Those are supposed to be prices attributable in the market. Arm's length is the expression, but there's no basis for comparison or no ability by either the IRS or the Department of Revenue to really examine the pricing that goes on internally with these companies. And when you consider that companies that are doing well, prospering, and thriving here in Minnesota are doing so because of the tremendous tax effort that the rest of us go to, building good roads, an education system, a research universities, safe communities, overall quality of life, it's worthy of public policy consideration. The way this bill works, Madam Chair, is it further defines a domestic corporation for the purpose of the unitary tax reporting so that those companies that are incorporated in a tax haven have to be a part of the unitary, or those companies that are operating not in tax havens but have 20% or more of their income attributed to those countries, or if a foreign company is operating here and has their average of property payroll or sales 20% or more here in the U.S., they would all be defined for the purpose of unitary reporting. That's my presentation. We have a few folks who would like to share some thoughts, and Madam Chair, we promise to there's a lengthy list, so we promise to keep them all very, very brief.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Are there any questions for Senator Dibble before we go to the testifiers? Seeing none, I would invite Mr. Dane Smith and Ms. Jennifer Schaubach to
Madam Chair, Ms. Schaubach is not with us, so we can go to Dan Garnas.
Then I would invite Pastor Garnas to come up with Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the division. I'm Dane Smith, President of Growth and Justice, and we're a public policy research organization focused on broadening prosperity in Minnesota through smarter public investments and policies that foster both economic growth, economic justice, and business growth. We've long championed, as a general principle, tax reforms that lower tax rates for Minnesota businesses where possible, and especially if it can be done through base broadening and removing special favors, deductions, credits, and exemptions. Governor Tim Pawlenty actually pushed for reforms in this general direction, and we were very pleased to see Governor Dayton pursue this policy more aggressively with several proposals to curtail tax avoidance through various international reporting mechanisms and also to lower the corporate rate. I'd like to speak in support of this bill and make just three big, broader points about reducing costly tax expenditures, which should be properly viewed as a form of business subsidy. The best, most concise description of what's going on here, I think, comes from a recent Minnesota House research brief, which describes tax havens as, quote, shifting of profit reporting to low-tax locales far out of proportion to any possible actual business operations in those countries, unquote. China and India and Mexico and Canada are not tax havens, tiny nations with populations and economies that could not possibly sustain the economic activity reported there are tax havens. We do live in an increasingly interconnected world. We want our Minnesota businesses and corporations to operate profitably around the globe in a responsible and ethical manner. We do not favor isolationism or protectionist policy, but at the same time, our public investments by our state and local governments right here in Minnesota in education and workforce training and business-serving infrastructure also are good for these businesses in the long run. And, of course, your job as legislators is to serve the greater good for your Minnesota constituents. This bill, this option, has the benefit of not being a general tax rate increase, but it closes off a legal but apparently unintended tax avoidance. And it would not affect any of the struggling tens of thousands of mom-and-pop operations, small, medium businesses, micro-businesses in Minnesota. Most of our homegrown small businesses can't play this game, and many, I'm sure, would argue that it's not fair to them as they try to compete in this broader, global, much larger economy. Finally, I'm not aware of any reliable or comprehensive detailed studies that show job creation or direct benefits to Minnesota from the millions that are not being paid as a result of tax havens. And we do know that recouping some of these lost revenues would enable more investment for our middle-class families and businesses that really do benefit from schools and colleges and transit systems and highways and other business-building infrastructure systems. So thank you. Be happy to try to respond to questions.
Is there questions for Mr. Smith? Thank you very much. Pastor Garnas.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Dan Garnas. I'm pastor at Grace University Lutheran Church, which is on the east bank of the University of Minnesota campus. I live in St. Paul with my spouse, our daughter, and our granddaughter. I've been involved with issues of access to quality health care as well as building healthy communities in both a local and national level through ISAIAH. Part of a pastor's job is to study Scripture, seeking to understand how Scripture speaks to our situation today. There is a prophetic witness in the Judeo-Christian tradition. The prophets do not mince words. When the life of the community is out of balance, when the needs of all are not equally prioritized, when the economic system is simply not fair, when some find ways to not pay their fair share. The prophets condemn systems where equity does not exist, where opportunity is only for some, where resources are hoarded by the few at the expense of the many, where the most vulnerable are not treated well. Earlier in my history, before becoming a pastor, I was the vice president of a small community bank. To keep the bank running, it was necessary to make a profit. But it was also important to contribute to the community, to care about people's lives, to know when people were hurting, to give back to the people that made the bank viable by their business with us. It was also part of our duty to the community to pay taxes, which is yet another way to strengthen the infrastructure of the community, and I know you all know that. A few weeks ago, through a report in the Star Tribune based on the research of U.S. PIRG, I learned that the Minnesota Department of Revenue reported that the median tax paid by corporations in Minnesota is zero. Zero. I also learned that Minnesota has lost $1.95 billion in tax revenue due to multinational corporations using tax havens and tax loopholes. I think it's fair to say that these facts are shocking and pretty outrageous, at least they were to me. The prophets of old would not be silent in the face of such unfairness, such inequity, and such greed. We should not be silent either. As a huge majority of the citizens of this state pay their fair share to make this state run, to educate our children, to care for the most vulnerable, these huge corporations seem to be taking care of their own executives and shareholders. In our community at Grace, we talk a good deal about the fact that we get to give. It's not that we have to give, but we get to. It was true in the bank as well. It was a privilege to be part of the community, and we did our best to give back. I know that some corporations are also very good citizens, caring more about than just profit. It would be good if all corporations were thankful that they get to contribute their fair share to the community. The prophets don't just condemn, they show the people a better way. That way always begins by listening to the cries of the most vulnerable in the community. And we all know there are many needs in the state of Minnesota. We need together to find a way to invest in all the people of the state, to all, and that all includes all corporations, to all pay our fair share, to all take part in building a better Minnesota. This bill, I believe, is one part of making this happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Pastor Garnas. We next have Art and Jane Price from Shoreview, and are they here? As they're coming forward, Senator Dibble, I wonder if you'd look at your list on page 2, line 221, number 17. When I look at another list, it is the Isle of Man. Is that what you meant?
Isle of Man. I'm sorry, number 17 here?
Yes.
Did it mean Isle of Man?
It's yes. I think it's the Isle of Man.
Yes.
Spelled I-S-L-E, then O-F, and then M-A-N. Senator Dietzick moves to strike on line 2.21, man, and insert of man. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Dibble will now hear from Art and Jane Price.
Madam
Price,
Chair,
if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair and committee members, we are Art and Jane Price from Coon Rapids, Minnesota, and we are here to speak in favor of Bill 1237, proposed by Senator Dibble and Representative Hornstein. This is our first time testifying at the Capitol, and we are excited to be here advocating for our daughter and others like her. Our 42-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, was deprived of oxygen at birth, leaving her with profound brain injuries that have resulted in a lifetime of complicated needs and total care. On top of all her disabilities, Elizabeth survived stage 3 bladder cancer 7 years ago. We say she lives on love. Luckily for Elizabeth, she is a resident of Minnesota. Elizabeth lived with us throughout her childhood. When she was 20, a rare and sought-after group home slot opened near our home, and Liz was given the opportunity to move away, grow up, and establish her own life, just as her sisters have. We consider her to be as successful an adult as her younger sisters, who both have families and professional careers. Elizabeth's existence is always fragile because it depends on the generosity of the government. The past years have seen cuts that often throw her group home, medical, and day program providers into panic mode, as well as her parents. Elizabeth could be any one of you or your family members. All it would take is the right bump on the head to be in her situation. We need more revenue in Minnesota to invest in those who cannot care for themselves. The choice is clear. It is our understanding that our corporations are flush with cash. We need to address corporate loopholes and bring some of that money back to Minnesota. Too many of our disabled adults are denied the services they and their families so desperately need. They need our help, and let's give it to them.
Thank you. Ms. Price. Mr. Price, did you want to speak?
Madam Chair, no, I don't.
I
get too emotional.
And I won the coin toss, so I got to speak.
I see. Well, we appreciate you very much coming before us today and telling your family story. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening.
Mr. Chris Connery, Take Action Minnesota, and is Anna Angelis Ferris here? If she would come forward as well. We'll hear from both of you. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Sure. My name is Chris Connery. I work for Take Action Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today to speak in favor of Senator Dibble's bill, Senate File 1237. We support this bill for three reasons. First, the problem of international income shifting is a large and growing problem for the United States and Minnesota, and it leads to substantial declines in state revenue. A recent report by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group reveals that state governments across the United States lost $39.8 billion in tax revenue due to tax havens in 2011. Minnesota's share of that loss was estimated to be over $1.3 billion. Second, Senate File 1237 provides a solution. This bill is modeled on a Montana law that has existed since 2003. The experience in Montana has been positive. Tax haven reporting has been revenue positive. In 2010, in a state with roughly one-fifth the population of Minnesota, it raised $7.2 million on $102.9 million in income that otherwise would have gone unreported to the state. And administratively, it posed no noticeable costs or challenges to be administered there. Third, this change would benefit Minnesotans. Having a tax system that uses a full and accurate picture of a business's income is reasonable, it's fair, and it's good policy. Finally, the money raised by this change could be used to invest in things that both families and businesses rely on in Minnesota: good schools, transportation, economic development. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Connery. Any questions for Mr. Connery?
Madam Chair, I do,
Senator
just
Dibble.
Because I'm a heavy supporter of the forest products industry. We have another handout from, it's that letter that I handed to you earlier from Mr. Bucks of Montana that describes some of the experience of, with the Montana
law.
We'll
send a page over to pick it up and distribute it. Ms. Angeles Ferries, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anna Angeles Ferris. I am a resident of Hopkins and a custodian of the Lakeville School District. This is also my first time testifying. I'm here today to testify in favor of the Senate File 1237. I've worked in public schools off and on for over 30 years, and over that time I have seen the impact of inadequate school funding and the effects that it has had on students and their families. 28 years ago, I moved to California, and I worked in the school systems out there. The overcrowding in the public schools of California were terrible. The overcrowding in the public schools became so bad that the students had to rotate through the schools in shifts all year round, because there wasn't enough room to fit the entire student body in all the buildings at one time. Over the school year, the school was structured in four shifts, and students and teachers literally had to keep moving in and out of buildings in order to make room for the next shift of kids. It was so bad that I decided to move back to Minnesota. I was 7 months pregnant at the time with my second child, but I just couldn't stand the idea of my daughters going to attend schools that were in such bad shape. I grew up in Minnesota, and I went to school in Minnesota, so I knew what quality education looked like. When I was a student, Minnesota was known nationwide for its excellent education. This is the education I want my grandsons, who are now entering the public school system, to experience. But sadly, over the years, I have seen Minnesota's education suffer greatly due to improper funding. We're looking at yet another state budget deficit next year. This means that once again, we're going to have to make some tough decisions. The bill before you today is asking each of you, what are your priorities? How should we spend the state's money? To buy down the tax bill of the profitable multinational corporations, or to pay for our children's to finally get the excellent education that Minnesota was once known for? I think you know what my answer would be. I urge you to please support Senate File 1237. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Angeles Ferris. Are there questions for the witness or comments? Thank you for your testimony, and I hope that you find occasion to visit us again sometime.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Madam President?
Senator Gazelka, it's okay.
What can I say? Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, do we know how much some of these major companies that are in Minnesota actually do contribute in taxes to Minnesota? I know we're talking about what they could be contributing more so in Minnesota, but I'm curious if you've done any of the research on that, because I've read most of your articles here now, and I look at it and I see, you know, companies like Medtronic, 3M, St. Jude's, United Health Group, 3M, et cetera, Target, and, you know, even contrary to some of the testimony there, I think that these companies have been very good corporate citizens in Minnesota. I don't feel like they're somehow listed as evil in some sense or greedy in some sense. And, you know, I don't see any of that data here as far as what they pay in. I read the comment about or one of the articles that said that Minnesota's behind only five other states in terms of getting this extra tax revenue. And I wonder if that may correlate to the fact that we're fifth or sixth most aggressive in how we tax businesses in Minnesota. So if you have any of that data, I'd like to see that. I think that would be good for the whole committee to know how much they're actually paying into Minnesota.
Well, Senator Dibble? Well,
Madam Chair, by and large, tax returns are confidential, and there's a lot of proprietary data and the like, and so it's hard for us to, you know, to ask for confidential tax returns. But you know, to your point, I mean, you know, through some analysis and the like, you know, if you've seen some of the research, you've seen, the best guess or some of the publicly reported amounts that some of our larger Fortune 500 companies are reporting of having sheltered and stashed overseas. So we definitely have that sense. To respond to your point, you know, I don't think anyone's attributing evil intent or evil motive or suggesting that corporations are bad citizens. That's not the purpose or intent of my bill. My purpose is to simply bring forward a matter of public policy and discussion. Are these havens, are these loopholes in the public interest and in a function of good public policy or not? And that's the choice and the question in front of the committee today. As far as getting tax data that's otherwise confidential, I don't know if we can do that. We can ask the Department of Revenue if anyone's here who can help us with that. But I don't think we can.
Ms. Von Mosch.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, the individual taxpayer information is confidential. So really the only thing we can give you other than information and a revenue estimate would be the amount of corporate taxes paid on an annual basis, and that is in all the budget materials that you have. But like a lot of information with individual taxpayers, it would be confidential.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to encourage us to proceed with great caution. I mentioned that before when we talked about the foreign operating royalties discussion. It was interesting. I walked with one of those testifiers in the hallway after. I won't mention which one at this point, but he said it was an interesting comment. He said, you know, if you go through with this, that was the other one, but I think they're similar. He said, right now we have about 70% of our workforce in Minnesota. And he said, we may keep the same number of employees, but if we don't get some of the benefits tax-wise here, in 10 years we may have the same number of employees, but it may only be 30% of our business force. And because one of the fundamental goals of a business is to make a profit. I mean, profit is not evil. It's the lifeblood of a business. And so, you know, I looked at all the companies that are listed here, and I consider them all very, very good corporate citizens for Minnesota, and I don't view them as doing something. You know, I see all the good they're doing for our state, and I want to make sure that they remain here, grow here, succeed here, and in the end, we all benefit from that, including more revenue coming in.
Thank you. Senator Thompson?
Madam Chair.
Or Senator Dibble?
I'll draw everyone's attention to the letter from the former Commissioner of Revenue in Montana, who argues that, first of all, let me just say, no one is saying, the only person who said the word evil in this room so far is Senator Gazelka. no one else is casting aspersion or attributing motive or the like to these companies. This is a discussion of public policy and what's advisable. But in Montana's experience, going to the unitary apportionment system and the administrative effort and the like, as well as the economic impact, was all positive. So take some time to read Mr. Buck's letter and learn a little bit more about the Montana experience. The fact is that if companies, in fact, are creating artificially high expenses for the subsidiaries that are located here, attributing, depressing profits artificially and attributing income elsewhere that perhaps shouldn't be attributed or is not advisable, that's the question we have in front of us. Creating these financing mechanisms so that interest is deducted here and interest paid elsewhere is taxed elsewhere. That's the question in front of us. Mr. Smith from Growth and Justice cited that there's no evidence that this has any effect in either direction on the relative prosperity and growth of companies.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out to folks that for publicly reporting companies, there are quarterly reports filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And while it's true that, as Ms. Von Mosch correctly stated, some specific data pertaining to the nature of the company can't be ascertained, but you can certainly determine the amount of taxes paid state, federal, and otherwise. So that information is available on reporting companies. Secondly, I agree with Senator Dibble, this shouldn't be about casting aspersions on companies or those sorts of things, but it did kind of turn into, rather than discussing these tax havens in particular and what that means, it kind of turned into a general, once again, not paying their fair share kind of discussion. And it really shouldn't be lost on people that a corporation is simply a conduit for the payment of taxes. A corporation is, as we all know in this business, is a legal fiction. It's a creation of the state that is used as a conduit to do business. And ultimately, all taxes are paid by people, whether it is a person of normal means, a middle-class person who has a little bit of money in a 401k, and because higher taxes are paid by a company that participates in their 401k, their investment returns are lower. Or higher taxes results in having to lay off employees or hire less employees or put less money into research and development. The point is that it sounds so good to attack corporations. They've got to pay their fair share, but they don't pay it. The tax incidence falls on people. And so we need to keep that in mind when we're engaging in this sort of, we got to get them because they didn't pay their fair share. Well, you know what? If tax rates go up for a particular corporate citizen in this state, most of which are fine corporate citizens, it may result in unemployment of the very kinds of people that we should be trying to help with our policies in this state.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. I appreciate your perspective, and I might agree with you if one didn't contemplate the fact that there are ever-increasing accumulation of cash, that many, many companies, even through the Great Recession, accumulated ever more stashes of just cash in their bank accounts. And have been, for a long time now, a number of decades, have continued to pay those at the top of the corporate ladder ever more and ever more and ever more, while at the same time seeking to pay those who are actually doing the work in those corporations ever less and ever less and ever less, and contributing less to their health care and contributing less to their retirement accounts and the like. So I appreciate your perspective that ultimately taxes are paid by the end user and the consumer. But the simple fact remains is that we have income stratification, the likes of which we haven't seen since the 1920s going on in this country. And so not all these profits that are being cited are necessarily attributable to positive effect in our tax system, nor in the wages and benefits that workers at the front lines are receiving.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, but let's remember that, in fact, when that cash is being accumulated, we're talking a lot about how there was reference to, I believe, corporations taking deductions that are maybe illegitimate or overstated. Well, when they accumulate cash, those are retained earnings, and those are corporate profits, and they're paying one of the highest corporate income tax rates in the state, in the country, in the state of Minnesota. So the accumulation of cash is not tax avoidance. In fact, it's when you have all kinds of retained earnings, there's a very high tax cost associated with that. And the reason it's being done is because of the uncertainty in the economy, frankly, because at the national level, we have people that are interested in doing the same kinds of things that we're trying to do in this state, which is make it more difficult for businesses to employ people and get income to families and the like. So retained earnings are not a good argument for you because they're taxed.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble. I thought I heard you say that corporations are artificially inflating or accounting for their expenses. And I'm not aware of that, but I know that we have a Department of Revenue that audits. And I know that we have an IRS that audits. And I don't think that that is a fair statement for you to make without more information about that. And when you say that you're not casting aspersions, I think you just did. We have very fine corporate partners in the state of Minnesota that provide an awful lot of the funds that we need to run state government. And they employ Minnesotans all over, and they take on the services of our small businesses and the vendors. And I think your effort here is misplaced. But more importantly, as Senator Thompson said, we have one of the highest corporate tax rates in the nation in Minnesota, third highest already. And that's making us, leaving us in a place where we are not very competitive. But I'm hoping that since Ms. Von Mosch is here, she can help us clear up two things, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to know at least just generally the percentage of the revenues that we bring in the state of Minnesota, what percentages come from corporations. And then secondly, I'm hoping you can clear up for everyone, and hopefully Senator Dibble will acknowledge, that if you pass this bill, we're not talking about $1.3 billion, even though that's what all the news articles say. The fiscal note says $21 million per year. So I'm hoping Ms. Von Mosch can address those two questions, Madam Chair.
Ms. Von Mosch, in addition to that, would you provide us with information on what the effective rate is for corporations as opposed to the marginal rate, and how that ranks among the states? Ms. Von Mosch.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I don't have all my spreadsheets in front of me at this time, but I believe that the corporate tax rate brings in about $800 million a year. Is that correct, Ms. McQuay? She's checking. But I believe that the corporate franchise tax brings in about 15% of the state's revenues. And I think Ms. McQuay has her computer with her, so she can confirm my numbers on this.
What about the effective tax rate for corporate?
Madam Chair, I don't have that information with me. That is something that's very difficult to calculate. I believe at one time it was calculated to be about 4.5%, but I would want to check and confirm, and I can get back with you on that.
And that would be interesting to us also, relative to effective tax rates for corporations in other states, where we rank there. Ms. McQuay?
Madam Chair and members, the corporate franchise tax for the based on the February forecast was $2 billion. And I had done the calculation of the November forecast, which was just under 6%. So just real quickly, I'm going to do the calculation based on the February forecast of total revenues for the general fund. Madam Chair and members, the corporate franchise tax is approximately 5.9% of the total tax revenues for the general fund for the 14-15 biennium.
Thank you.
Chair. And then to the fiscal note, Madam Chair.
I beg pardon, Senator Ortman?
I had asked Ms. Von Mosch if she could address the fiscal note because there's been...
The revenue estimate?
Oh, I'm sorry, the revenue estimate, because there's been quite a bit of conversation about there being $1.3 billion that the state isn't collecting, but the revenue note on Senator Dibble's bill shows much less than that. It's $21 million.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman,
Ms. Von Mosch.
We did look at that, the earlier study that was referenced on tax havens, and we were actually quite surprised at the high number attributed to Minnesota. And we are looking into some of the data that they used in their research, and we think that we would have more confidence with our revenue estimate than in that report.
Senator Ortman and then Senator Dibble.
Question for either of you. Do either of you know what Montana's corporate tax rate is compared to Minnesota's?
Senator Dibble, do you know?
I don't, Madam Chair.
Not at this time.
Senator Dibble, did you want to
Madam Chair, I would just encourage...
We do have two more people to testify, and we have five more bills.
I encourage members to look at the Congressional Research Service study that talks about price shifting and some of the internal cost shifting that goes on and the inability of the IRS or the Department of Revenue to really determine what the market would bear for some of these expenses that are shifted from one company to another in another country and the like. It's the arm's length system. Even Senator Byron Dorgan has said this is just simply a system that doesn't work. It's not functional, and sometimes there's just simply an absence of market data to figure out whether or not the kind of prices that are attributed for goods and services from one internal company to another for the purpose of suppressing the profits of the company located here and attributing those to the company located elsewhere. That's why the unitary system is just a much cleaner and more effective way of determining overall profits and costs.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. We have two more people who wish to testify on this bill, Ms. Cadoon, Ms. Larson. Ms. Cadoon, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, if it's okay if we'll have Jill Larson go first.
Certainly. Ms. Larson, if you'd identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jill Larson. I'm here representing the Minnesota Business Partnership. Appreciate the committee's time. I want to lay out a few different concerns about the bill, sort of in a few different categories. The first is that we really feel like this puts Minnesota companies at a competitive disadvantage. The high corporate tax rate was mentioned earlier, but this proposal would essentially add additional Minnesota tax onto some Minnesota companies solely because of where they choose to do business, solely based on what country they choose to do business in, or solely based on where they choose to incorporate their affiliates. And their foreign competitors would not be subject to this tax. Minnesota companies do business in other countries for lots of reasons, one of which is because that's where the growth is. A lot of our companies, their sales growth is out of Minnesota and outside of the United States. That's where the growing markets are. That growth helps create jobs back here at the headquarters in Minnesota. And this proposal, we believe, sends a message to Minnesota companies, and it creates a disincentive to be headquartered here, because what happens if you do is all of your non-U.S. affiliates, all that foreign income will be taxed as Minnesota income. It would really make Minnesota an outlier. As was mentioned, Montana is the only other state that blacklists certain countries. No other state does this. Our other concern is that this essentially imposes worldwide unitary reporting, which essentially is, when many states tried to do this many, many years ago, it created some really strong objections from United States foreign trading partners. It actually was discussed in the British Parliament. And what the solution was to create a water's edge election. And that was kind of the compromise that was reached between the federal government and other countries. But this proposal, the way we're reading it, would not allow companies to make that water's edge election. The other concerning issue is that this bill lists countries. It basically lists, blacklists certain countries. And I think the list was probably taken from a list that the OECD had many, many years ago. That is a very outdated list. It doesn't exist anymore. The OECD does not list tax haven countries. In fact, the United States Department of Treasury opposes listing countries as tax havens. I'm going to give you a quote from a Department of Treasury letter. There is no agreed-upon definition of tax haven or list of jurisdictions that should be considered tax havens. It goes on to say, because any such list is likely to be regarded as a blacklist and may be used as the basis for negative measures, such a list may inappropriately negatively affect our economic and other relations with listed countries. The Department of Treasury doesn't like these because it affects foreign trade. You know, I know Minnesota is trying to increase foreign trade. There's initiatives in the governor's proposal to increase money for the trade office. We're trying to bring more foreign direct investment into Minnesota. This sends a message to those companies that would want to do that, don't come to Minnesota. And there are some constitutional concerns with the bill. You'll note there's a separability clause in the language. And to the extent that states impact the federal government's ability to determine foreign affairs, there could be some real constitutional concerns. And as was mentioned earlier, the Department of Revenue has tools to address these issues. The federal government has tools. I mean, we really feel this is a federal issue. And so we have some strong concerns about the bill. Thank you.
Ms. Cadoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I'm representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're here in opposition to Senate File 1237. I'll agree with the comments that Ms. Larson mentioned and just mention a few other issues. One thing I want to mention is kind of the trends in other countries on corporate taxation. The trends in other countries is really to lower the corporate tax rate as well as going to a territorial basis of taxation. And what this means is they're just taxing income earned within their borders and not taxing foreign income. The U.S. still is on a worldwide basis, so they're taxing foreign income as well. One question was related to the effective tax rate. When you just look at the effective tax rate or statutory rates of U.S. companies combined with the Minnesota rate, as was mentioned, we're one of the top in the nation. If you look at we're about 15% points higher than the OECD average for these industrial nations. On the effective tax rate, we're about 7.6% with other foreign countries. So to address the chair's question, the larger policy question is what really is the policy rationale for Minnesota to tax income earned outside of Minnesota and outside of the U.S.? That's really the bigger policy question. And as I mentioned, the trend of the other countries is going to that territorial basis. And the reason they've done that is really to attract and strengthen their multinational corporations, to attract capital from abroad, and also to create and encourage more headquartered jobs in their country. The second point I wanted to make as well is we really disagree with the underlying premise that if you're doing business in these countries that are listed, that you're there for nefarious purposes. There's a lot of reasons to be doing business in those countries. A lot of it is to simply make sure you have access to those foreign markets and those foreign investments and not for the tax evasion that seems to be alluded to. There was a handout that you should have had on the OECD. That list, as Ms. Larson mentioned, it lists the countries that the OECD, instead of listing tax havens, a report put out in 1998. Instead, what they have done is they're working with these countries on the exchange of tax information and more transparency. And so you should have a handout that says all these countries basically that are listed are no longer considered tax havens. And so hopefully you have that in your packet and can take a look that these countries are no longer blacklisted. The fourth point I wanted to make is that we really should be focused on tax policy and how we can encourage job growth in Minnesota and allow our companies to compete globally and encourage more exports. Ultimately, I believe this is an issue best dealt with at the federal level as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Are there questions or comments for these witnesses?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman, and then we are going to bring this discussion to a close. Senator
yep.
Ortman.
I just have a little bit of follow-up information. I appreciate Mr. Mickelberg. I asked the question before, what was Montana's corporate tax rate? In Minnesota, our tax rate is 9.8%.
Montana's is 6.75%. They have a whole different approach to corporate taxation. I don't think it's comparable.
Ms. Cadoon?
I just want to one follow-up point with Montana. I also want to point out that Montana also has zero Fortune 500 companies, whereas Minnesota has 19.
Senator Diebold, some final comments, and then we're bringing this discussion to a close, and we'll be laying your bill over as amended. Senator Diebold.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Alaska and West Virginia have similar laws, and California has got one under consideration. I just wanted to correct the record there. Absolutely, there are, as both Ms. Larson and Ms. Cadoon testified, totally legitimate reasons for companies to be undertaking these business when there's business activities going on in other places for the purpose of manufacturing and selling and finding foreign markets and et cetera, et cetera. And even in those instances where, there's just simply have a P.O. box in an office building, some island nation, it's legal, and they're doing what they're allowed to do. But I just remind folks that, if they're actually legitimately trying to attribute business activity and profits, if you add up what these companies are doing in some of these tiny, tiny nations, it stretches credibility to consider that all the profits attributed by these U.S. companies in excess of 600% of those companies' gross domestic product, that those are profits being realized through actual business activities in those countries. That's just a simple fact of math. And so with that, I appreciate your consideration of Senate File 1237.
Thank you, Senator Diebold. I think we've had a wide-ranging discussion, and I appreciate your bringing the bill before us. And with that, we will lay over Senate File 1237 as amended. The next bills up are Senate File 526, and since they deal with the same area and looks like we're having some of the same testifiers, I would also invite Senator Coonan to present along with Senator Dietzick, Senate File 524. Senator Dietzick, Senate File 526.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I have today Senate File 526, a higher education scholarship tax credit. The University of Minnesota Minneapolis campus and Augsburg College are in my district. So over the summer, I had many discussions with administration and students about the cost of education and how students are leaving college with huge debt. One idea that we bounced around was how to help students, and we came up with to allow donors who contribute to a merit-based scholarship fund to get a tax credit. To receive the credit, they would have to contribute to a scholarship fund for Minnesota residents who go to Minnesota schools. I have an A3 amendment. It is a delete all amendment.
The A3 amendment is being distributed, and I would, just for the information of members, the bill summary is not drawn to the amendment. It's drawn to the bill as introduced. So just set that aside as we're going through it. Senator Dietzick moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Try that again. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thanks. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. I also like to thank Nora Pollack for all her help, last-minute help with revisions. And with me is Mr. Fritzenreiter from the University of Minnesota to help explain the idea in the bill.
Mr. Fritzenreiter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name again is Richard Fritzenreiter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota. As Senator Dietzick mentioned, discussions began last summer also with President Kaler with the goal of coming up with and trying to think about new strategies, new policy ideas to help students reduce costs. Our goals last summer when we began talking about this was to find ways or propose ways to increase charitable giving by individuals for scholarships, find ways to reduce the cost of college for full-time students and their families, and another one was to reduce the burden of students repaying loans. We actually came up with five ideas, and of course two of those ideas are here today in the form of Senator Dietzick's bills and Senator Cohen's bill. What the bill before you, the amended bill before you does, is it the proposal is that it would allow a credit against individual income tax for contributions to fund merit-based scholarships for students in Minnesota, for full-time students. The bill would allocate $20 million in each of the next 2 years. It was really set up as a pilot program to see how this proposal would work. There is a formula in the bill that distributes those that $20 million to participating institutions. And then the participating institutions, so an example would be that the University of Minnesota Foundation would have the ability to provide inform a donor. Let's take, for example, a new donor who's interested in contributing to scholarships. The university could offer in that discussion with the donor to try to incent them. This concept was an idea to incent donors, particularly new donors, to give by providing them, as it's amended in the bill, with up to a 33% credit for the amount that they would contribute. So it is designed as an incentive to try to take that $20 million and really turn it into considerably more money for scholarships for students. This provision applies to public and private institutions in the state. It's not just the University of Minnesota. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Mr. Fitzenreuter, does the A3 amendment allow an individual not only to get a income tax credit, but to continue to take a deduction on Schedule A?
Madam Chair, members, yes. Still allows that.
Okay. Wow. Are there questions for Senator Dietzick or Mr. Fitzenreuter? Senator Coonan, do you want to explain your bill then? We'll move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 524 would establish a student loan repayment tax credit. And I'm sure many of you...
Before we do that, just so I don't forget, we'll lay over Senate File 526 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Senator Coonan.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure many of you have been hearing from students and parents about the rising cost of obtaining a post-secondary degree. And this is a problem because at a time when it is becoming increasingly necessary to have a degree to succeed in today's global economy, we are saddling our young people with very large amounts of student debt as they finish their education. State disincentives in higher education in Minnesota and across the nation has shifted the burden to pay for college education onto students and families. This is unfortunate. More than ever, we need students to obtain a degree in order for them to find a good job, which are becoming increasingly complex and sophisticated. We also need students to get a post-secondary education because Minnesota no longer is competing against neighboring states. We are competing actually with countries and around the globe. We must ensure that our students can afford to go to school, graduate in strong financial position, and enter workforce prepared to succeed. There are actually some students today that are graduating with student loans payments that would actually look like a mortgage payment. So we're talking about some pretty substantial amounts of money. According to the Office of Higher Education, over 190,000 students in Minnesota receive a subsidized Stanford or Perkins student loan with an average amount of $3,700 during the 10 and 11 school year. Projections for students for beginning school in 12 and 13 and completing a four-year degree program indicate that students will borrow approximately $18,800 in Stanford or Perkins loans. Again, a large amount of money for somebody trying to get started. Madam Chair and members, if your students are similar to the ones in my district, and I'm sure they are, that this is a lot of debt for a student to assume, and we need to send him or her into the job market. I am bringing this bill today so we can discuss this tax policy approach to help students. Madam Chair, I also have Mr. Richard Fitzenreiter here to speak to the bill also. Thank you.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, if you'd reintroduce yourself, please, we'd be happy to have your testimony on Senate File 524.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Richard Fitzenreiter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota. Senate File 524 is a proposal that would create a refundable credit against individual income tax for repayment of a subsidized Stanford or Perkins student loan. The credit would only apply to loans incurred to pay tuition and fees for the academic year of 2012-2013 and later. It's not retroactive. An individual could claim a credit for the amount paid in principal interest during the tax year up to a maximum of $500.
Are there questions for Mr. Fitzenreuter or Senator Coonan on this proposal? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak? If you would come forward, please, to testify. Good morning. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Forsty. I'm an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. I study mathematics and finance, and I serve as the chair of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition, which represents students from across the University of Minnesota system, so on all five campuses.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I want to thank you for hearing this bill, as well as Senator Dedick's bill today, and for considering innovative policy options for addressing the issue of affordability of higher education in Minnesota. I'm here today, of course, in support of Senate File 524 and the creation of a student loan repayment tax credit. As members of this committee certainly know and have just heard, the cost of higher education in Minnesota has risen at an unprecedented rate in recent years. The bulk of that increased burden has been taken on by Minnesota students and families and has resulted in a high level of debt. In recent years, the average debt load of a student graduating with a four-year degree in Minnesota is nearly $30,000. That averages the third highest in the nation. There are certainly consequences of leaving our graduates with high debt burdens, especially as they begin their adult lives and enter the workforce. For instance, young people may choose to put off important life decisions that come with entering the adult workforce, decisions like starting a family or buying a home or a car. Considering the disinvestment in higher education students over the past decade, we certainly have a need to explore innovative and creative ways to provide relief to students and recent graduates, and I believe that this bill, Senate File 524, and the creation of a student loan repayment tax credit represents an excellent way to address that problem and merits strong consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forsty. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Forsty? Thank you. Mr. Serfenik, did you want to speak? If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Serfenik. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And I just want to briefly, for the record, indicate that the Private College Council and our member colleges are supportive of both of the tax credit proposals you've just heard. And we appreciate the work of the university and the authors in bringing forward these two proposals. Everyone's well aware of the challenges students face in affordability and student debt, and these are two good options for helping to address those challenging issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cirtvenik. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Cirtvenik? Or any further comments from Senator Kunin or Senator Dietzick? Mr. Cirtvenik, would you sign the witness list, please? Then we've already laid over Senate File 526. We will now lay over Senate File 524. Senator Kunin now has a few more bills here. We'll try to get to all of them. I wonder, Senator Kunin, if we could move. It looks like there are no witnesses on Senate File 1095, so let's put that one last because you have testifiers on the other two, and yeah, so that they would not have to come back if we don't get to that one. So first of all, we have Senate File 732 before us. Senator Kunin, Senate File 732.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 732 is a legislation that allows for volunteer tax credit of $500 for people serving as either a volunteer fireman, ambulance attendant, or emergency medical first responder. And I have with me here today Mr. Buck McAlpin and Ken Perlman to speak to the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. McAlpin, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, Buck McAlpin. I work with North Memorial Ambulance, and I'm representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association today. This is a list of items that we worked on with the Fire Chiefs Association, the Department of Public Safety, about 4 years ago, where we traveled around the state and put together a report of ways to retain and recruit and continue to have ambulance volunteers and fire volunteers. We have about 62% of our current EMS delivery system for ambulance is still volunteer-based. Quite a load of them still at North Memorial in a system our size. Out of 900, we depend on volunteers. Our impact that we look at to our system in the state by using volunteers is about $750 million. We think we save in what we pay to have. If we had to staff all those ambulances like we do in our large urban systems, our large outstate systems of EMS, and this is one of the last things. We added Minnesota Care Insurance, a continued pension, the Longevity Awards Program to keep volunteers in the program. And this was the last thing on our hit list that Representative Savick brought up over in the House. And it's always nice to see the fiscal note is a little bit of money, but we appreciate Senator Kunin bringing this back up before the committee for your consideration, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Mr. Fire Chief.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ken Prilliman. I'm the Fire Chief for the City of Brooklyn Park. I'm here representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Associations. Given the work that lies ahead for this committee, I don't envy the position that you're in, and hopefully within the next 3 minutes you'll share that sentiment with regard to the position the fire chiefs are in. As you may be well aware, of the 20,000 firefighters that protect our state, 90% of those are volunteer or paid on-call firefighters. Many of those earn very little, if nothing, for protecting their communities. This is despite the fact that they will invest hundreds of hours in training, ongoing training to maintain those certifications, and they will leave countless dinners, birthday parties, and anniversaries in order to protect their community. We're relying on a staffing model that we have used for the last 150 years, and although it has certainly served our state very well, it is showing very serious signs of being in a critical condition where fire chiefs throughout our great state are unable to recruit enough firefighters to adequately protect their communities. And as a result, an inadequate number of firefighters are available to fight fires and to respond to the needs of our community. This bill would be a very significant piece of a small list of benefits that we could offer a firefighter as a recruitment tool in order to entice and retain firefighters in this business and maintain this staffing model into the future by providing this level of support. consistent with some numbers that have been shared with you regarding the cost or the savings to the state that the Ambulance Association has just shared. If we were to attempt to transition from this paid-on-call volunteer fire service and force communities to hire firefighters because we could no longer attract and retain volunteers, it would be almost a $1 billion expense to the state of Minnesota. So we strongly support this bill. I'm sure that comes as no surprise, and we would ask that the committee do so as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Prilliman. Are there questions or comments for Mr. McAlpin or Chief Prilliman? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Coonan, do you have any other comments on that bill? Senate File 732. The next bill will be then Senate File 1301, Railroad Track Maintenance Expenditures Income Tax Subtraction. Is Mr. Wegner here? If he would join us at the, join Senator Coonan at the witness table. We have Senate File 1301. Senator Coonan, this is a kind of a different twist on something. Why don't you explain this bill to us?
Okay. Yeah, it does. It is a different twist. It's kind of an interesting look at this. But thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1301 is designed to recognize a federal tax credit that encourages short-line railroads to make upgrades to their tracks. And the bill will do this by allowing these small railroads to subtract the amount of the credit from their state taxable income. And so, in other words, the federal credit wouldn't be taxed on the state returns. It's a subtraction from the return.
Senator Coonan, so this is just for 1 year, because the federal credit is only good for, or the federal provision is only good for 2013. I mean, it's a 2014 fiscal impact, but it's, the federal credit is only good for calendar year 2013 and was part of the fiscal cliff. Is that I think staff has told us that. Is that accurate, Mr. Wegner? And why don't you begin your testimony now? If you identify yourself for the record, and tell us how this would work and what's going on right now with regard to track maintenance, et cetera, in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. Mark Wegner, I am the president of the Twin Cities and Western Railroad. I am also president of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. And this federal tax credit has basically been in effect on the federal level for about 7 years. But it keeps getting renewed on a biannual basis. And so this latest renewal was part of the fiscal cliff. It was co-sponsored by all 8 Minnesota representatives and both Minnesota senators on the federal level. What this tax credit does is, a short line railroad like us, we generate so many carloads, and those carloads help us maintain our track. But a short line railroad has less density, less carloads than the big railroads do, and so that, coupled with the fact that the track we inherited in 20 years ago had deferred maintenance on it, and a lot of the short lines in Minnesota are like that, what this tax credit does is it allows us to spend more money on the track. So, for example, prior to the tax credit, TC&W was installing 16,000 ties a year, and that was maintaining the status quo. But the track we inherited was over 100,000 ties deficit. So what this tax credit has allowed us to do is it has allowed us to put another 5,000 ties in, so 21,000 ties a year. We are now 60,000 ties deficit as opposed to 100,000 that we were 20 years ago. By the state also recognizing this tax credit, that will allow us to put in an additional 1,000 ties in. So the financial impact to the state is not great, but the significance to the short line railroads is significant. And it's the short lines, in addition to ties, there are some that have lighter rail, and then there are some that have bridge issues. And all of these things are, the tax credit was intended to make the short line rail network compatible with the North American rail network.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Wegner or Senator Coonan on this bill? And I think the revenue estimate is very informative about what the amount of the credit that's earned currently by these entities on the federal level is $4.3 million, and that would be throughout the year 2013. And then the Minnesota impact looks to me more like to be a goodwill gesture almost in terms of the amount of dollars. But nevertheless, I'm sympathetic to that. And I'm assuming that there are very few natural person owners of these short lines, but because of pass-through income, that's why it has an impact on the individual income tax as opposed to only being corporate. Any further questions on Senate File 1301? Seeing none, we will lay over Senate File 1301. Thank you, Mr. Wegner. Thank you, Senator Coonan, for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee.
The final bill that we have to discuss is Senate File 1095. It's also Senator Coonan's bill, an income tax credit for long-term unemployed individuals. Senator Coonan, please explain your bill.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And what Senate File 1095 does is allows a credit for hiring long-term unemployed
individuals. We do now have a preliminary estimate, at least from the department, on your bill. Senator Coonan.
Thank you. All right, thank you, Madam Chair. This provides a 40% tax credit to an employer for qualified wages paid to a qualified long-term unemployed person. A qualified individual may not have been a student for at least 6 months during the year before being hired, must be unemployed at least 12 months during the past 2 years before being hired, and must have received unemployment at least 12 months during the 2 years before being hired. The qualified wage amount is up to $10,000 per year. Wages do not include on-the-job training if the employer receives federally funded payments for the training, and wages do not include federal work supplementation payments made to the employer. So there's an attempt here to avoid double dipping. Other ineligible wages, the employer or the taxpayer isn't eligible if the employee is a dependent, family member, or member of the household, or if the individual owns more than 50% of the business, and if the taxpayer is an estate or a trust, the individual is a family member or household member of a grantor, beneficiary, or fiduciary of the estate or trust. And the credit is not allowed if the individual has at any time in the past been employed by the employer. The individual has to work at least 120 hours for the employer to qualify. And the bill also allows a 25% credit to the employer if the individual works less than 400 hours, but of course more than 120, and the credit that's granted the credits granted to pass-through entities are passed through to the partners, members, or shareholders in the proportion to their share of the entity's income. And the credit is non-refundable but can be carried forward for 15 years. And the credit is available for wages paid in taxable years after December 31, 2015, and that's the way the bill was sent over to me. Madam Chair and members, I realize that as the economy improves, this bill becomes less and less important. But I like the idea, so I wanted to bring it for the committee's consideration.
Well, thank you, Senator Coonan. Ms. Pollack, how common is it for credits to have such a long carry-forward period?
Madam Chair and members, I'm just thinking of other credits that we have, the small business or angel investment credit, I believe, is carried forward for 10, maybe carried forward for 10 years. The historic structure rehabilitation credit, there is a carry forward on that. I'm not sure how long it is, but I think it's 3 years.
3 years.
And of course, the credit in Senator D6's bill that we heard today, 526, would allow a carry forward for 10 years. 15 years, I'm not sure how common that is.
The point of it is that there's not a single common carry forward period depending on what the credit is.
Madam Chair, that's
correct. Just to make sure members
yes.
are aware of that. Senator Coonan, you know, we probably should have heard your bill when we were hearing the bills for credits for hiring veterans, because I think that is a particular group in our population now that we're extremely sensitive to as they return from active duty and no longer, we would hope, are going to be at risk for deployment, but are still really trying to, become part of their community life again. And I think this is well intentioned, but from my own point of view, I think I'd be more inclined to look at those bills as a way of having an impact on a specific sector that is facing the uncertainties of unemployment, but I appreciate your bringing the bill forward.
And Madam Chair, I actually agree with you. You know, I like the general idea here, but as the economy improves, and Minnesota is doing better than right. we are nationally, so this becomes less and less important as the economy continues to improve. But for returning servicemen and women, those are issues they're facing now, regardless of the economy. But thank you.
Thank you, Senator Coonan. We'll meet again tomorrow. We're meeting again tomorrow. Please check the agenda. We'll start at 9 o'clock. Yeah, I'm going to. We're going to lay over Senate File 1095, and there being no further business before the division, we stand adjourned.